Great job. And as the young people go out, would you like to turn to your Bibles again? Find Job chapter 1. Job chapter 1. And we're going to be camping out in the book. We're going to do the whole of Job this morning. Is that all right? You haven't got anything else on, have you, today? Is that okay? So Job chapter 1 today. The book of Job. And we're asking, as we're in this series, about, is God big enough? Is he big enough when your life looks like Job's? And hopefully on the screen we've got the series title up there as well, so we'll follow along. So hang on to Job chapter 1 and we'll be reading together as we go along through the series, through this sermon. So hang on to that as you find it. Job chapter 1, Old Testament, early on in your Old Testament, before Psalms and Proverbs and all that. Okay. Is God big enough to comfort my suffering? Ecclesiastes, there's another book in the Bible called Ecclesiastes, and it says this, there is a time for every season under heaven. Do you remember that one? Very famous. Time to be born, time to die, time to weep, time to dance. That wonderful passage. It's almost like poetry. And one of those seasons in your life, one of our seasons is winter, isn't it? Are you a winter person? Do you like winter? Not particularly. Yeah, I mean, some people love it, don't they? I mean, crisp mornings, the occasional smattering of snow. I like that bit. But the rest of winter I could do without. You know, the flat batteries and the, you know, the what's that, SAD, S-A-D, seasonal affective disorder, and all that stuff, and the darkness, and the, you know, darkness too much of the time, and the fact that it rains more than it snows. And I don't, you know, I'm more of a summer person, to be honest, if I'm really honest. But whatever you think about the season from a weather point of view, there's another kind of winter, and there's a winter of the soul that everyone feels the chill of at some point. You've all been there. We've all been there at some point, if you live long enough. The Bible doesn't ignore this wintry time in our lives. That's what I love about the Bible. It doesn't just say the nice things, the comfortable things. It talks about these things. And the Bible has some wintry books. Maybe the most famous wintry book about that season of life is Job. If you've ever read Job, it's a fascinating book. It's an interesting story about the human condition and a God who is actually bigger than your suffering. You may find that hard to believe, but he is. He's bigger than that. And we're just going to dive into the story. I'm going to lead you through as we think about, is God big enough to handle my suffering? And later on, we're going to be sharing communion, which I think is particularly poignant when you think about this subject. So let's dive in. Have you got Job? Job chapter 1, verse 1?
Page 425.
Page 425. Thank you, Malcolm. Good man. Excellent. Right, 425. Here you go. Verse 1. There was a man named Job who lived in the land of Uz. He was blameless. A man of complete integrity. He feared God and stayed away from evil. A really good guy. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters. He owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 team of oxen, and 500 female donkeys. He also had many servants. He was, in fact, the richest person in the entire area. Job's sons would take turns preparing feasts in their homes, and they'd also invite their 3 sisters to celebrate with them. And when the celebration ended, sometimes after several days, Job would purify his children. He would get up early in the morning and offer burnt offerings for each of them. When was the last time you did that for your kids? There you go. Have you had a burnt offering for your kid recently? Yeah, this guy really was passionate about righteousness and his family and everything. For Job said to himself, perhaps my children have sinned and have cursed God in their hearts. This was Job's regular practice. This guy was top notch. And he puts this pastor to shame, you know. And the story starts in the land of Uz, east of Israel. And the point of that is that Job is not part of Israel. So the problems in this book are not just the story of Israel. This is a guy who lives apart from Israel. This was a story of everybody, not just God's chosen people. This is our story. And in the beginning, everything is the way we think it ought to be. This is how the story should go. Job is a good guy. He's living a good life. He's a righteous man. He's so righteous he offers sacrifices, not just for himself, but for his kids. He's that good. And that's because there are two very important ideas floating around in Job's day. And in Job's day, here's what people thought. Number one, maybe God is offended, so I better sacrifice something to appease him. And number two, the amount of blessing you experience will be directly proportionate to the amount of obedience you offer. That was a common thought in those days. But you have to watch out in the book of Job, because this idea that there is a perfect relationship between blessing and obedience, how obedient I am will determine how blessed I am by God, is about to get torpedoed in the book of Job. Because trouble is coming to the land of Uz. And very bad things are about to happen to a very, very good man without any warning and without any explanation or reason. Sounds like life, doesn't it? Bad stuff happens to good people. And everybody knows what that feels like. You know what that's like. You've experienced it, and people around you have. Now, in verse 6, there's a radical shift of scenery, because we're looking at Job there in Uz. And you sort of need to picture the book of Job as a bit of a play. Do you like going to the theatre, seeing plays? Well, the book of Job is a bit like that. And you have to imagine it as a play, but as a play with two stages, one above the other, both of which action is going on both stages at the same time. That's what's going on in this book. The lower stage, the bottom stage, that's where Job is. That's where he lives, the land of Uz, our earth, our lives. But then there's an upper stage, and the upper stage is heaven. It's where God is. Now, this is crucial because we're in the audience and we can see both stages. We get told what's going on both stages. Job is on the bottom stage and he can't see the top one. He doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't know why it's going on. Here's, carry on reading. Let's have a look at this. One day, the members of the heavenly court came to present themselves before the Lord. And the accuser, Satan, came with them. Where have you come from? The Lord asked Satan. Satan answered the Lord, I have been patrolling the earth, watching everything that's going on. The Lord asked Satan, have you noticed my servant Job down there on that bottom stage? Have you noticed him? He is the finest man in all the earth. He is blameless, a man of complete integrity. He fears God and he stays away from evil. So there you go, Satan. There's a great example of one of my people. And Satan replies to the Lord, yes, but Job has good reason to fear God. You've always put a wall of protection around him and his home and his property. You've made him prosper in everything he does. Look how rich he is. But you reach out and take away everything he has. Oh, and he'll surely curse you to your face, God. All right. You may test him, the Lord said to Satan. Do whatever you want with everything he possesses, but do not harm him physically. So Satan goes out. This is the top stage. Job can't see that. He didn't hear the conversation. Satan goes out. Job loses his livestock. He loses his wealth. He loses his servants. Here's the shocker. He loses his children. Everything. And we pause as we look at that bottom stage and we wonder how he's going to react next. Here's what happens. Job 1 verse 20. Job stood up and he tore his robe in grief. He shaved his head. He fell to the ground to worship. He said, I came naked from my mother's womb and I will be naked when I leave. The Lord gave me what I had and the Lord has taken it away. You remember that phrase? The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Praise the name of the Lord, says Job. That's where that phrase, the Lord gives and takes, blessed be the name of the Lord. In all of this, Job did not sin by blaming God. It's amazing, isn't it? I wonder how many of us would have done the same. And we're told Job grieves, he worships, and he speaks word of blessing and praise, and in all this he did not sin when everything's taken away. And it all happens on that lower stage there. He can't see what's going on in the other one. We can. Chapter 2, the story switches back to the upper stage, and we get a look in on that. Then the Lord asks Satan, have you noticed my servant Job? He is the finest man in all the earth. He is blameless, a man of complete integrity. He fears God. He stays away from evil. And he has maintained his integrity, even though you urge me to harm him without any cause. Satan replied to the Lord, skin for skin. A man will give up everything he has to save his life. In other words, we're not finished yet. I bet I'm right, God. Reach out and take away his health, the one thing you wouldn't allow me to touch. Take away his health, and surely he will curse you to your face. All right. Do with him as you please, the Lord said, but spare his life. Now you need to know what's going on this upper stage right now. A lot of people think the key question in Job is, where is God when we hurt? Have you ever read Job with that? Where is God when I'm hurting? When it's all going pear-shaped and all going wrong? That's a huge question, but it's not the most important one. The key point in the upper stage and the whole book of chapter 1 is verse 9 of chapter 1. And Satan says this, which is an interesting phrase. Job has good reason to fear God. By fear, it means worship, respect. It's not be afraid of. It's God has good reason to reverence and honor God. And here's what's going on. Here's what's at stake in this whole book. Satan is saying this. God, the only reason Job worships you is out of his own self. Interest. It's just quid pro quo. You scratch his back, he scratches yours. Satan is charging God with being really naive about how the universe works and how the world works. You think Job loves you? He doesn't love you. He loves the way children love the ice cream man. He loves you for what you give him, not for you. You turn off the tap of blessing God and watch how fast Job will turn off his devotion to you. That's what this book is all about. That's what Job is all about. Satan is challenging the idea that there is such a thing as self-sacrificial love. That is the heart of the universe. That at the heart of everything God has created is self-sacrificial love. Satan says, no, it's not that. You know what's at the heart of the universe, says Satan? Self-interest. That's what makes the world go round. Self-interest. And God, you're naive if you think any different. And therefore things like suffering of individuals is just meaningless. It's just meaningless. If it's dog eat dog, survival of the fittest, everybody out for number one. If it's self-interest, then your suffering and mine are pointless, aren't they? If that's true, if it's just about self-interest. And this is a very current philosophy. If you read a book by Richard Dawkins, you ever read any? He's a wonderful atheist, Richard Dawkins. He hates God very much. I think there's something gone on in his past, which I'd love to ask him. Tell me about your childhood. But there's something in Richard Dawkins that is angry if you read his books. And he wrote a book called The Selfish Gene, and it says this, that there is nothing behind the force of life beyond dog eat dog, survival of the fittest. That is the core of, that's what Satan says. That is the heart of everything. That's what makes the world tick. Self-interest. And God says to Richard Dawkins and to Satan, no. No. This is cynical, it's misguided, but most importantly, it's wrong. The heart of the universe is not self-interest. At the core of the universe, and therefore at the core of life, is self-giving, self-sacrificial, selfless, even suffering love. That's what makes the world hold together. That's what's at the heart of existence, says God. That's what's at stake in this story. Is the devil right? Or is Job right? Is God right? So we catch up with the next stage of the book and we go back onto the lower stage of the play. Chapter 2, verse 7. Have a look at that. Chapter 2, verse 7. Job has good reason to fear God, to respect God, because you just give him stuff. That's why he loves you. He doesn't love you. He loves the stuff you give him. Here's what happens next. So Satan left the Lord's presence, verse 7 of chapter 2, and he struck Job with terrible boils from head to foot. Job scraped, this is a sad scene, isn't it? Never hope none of you ever have this experience. Job scraped his skin with a piece of broken pottery as he sat in ashes. That's a pretty sad scene. That's about as low as it gets. And Job gets hit with his second wave of suffering. This time there are some subtle differences in his response. You notice this? This time he doesn't fall down and worship. And his wife says to him, this is verse 9, are you still trying to maintain your integrity? Curse God and die. That's really cheerful for the missus there. Thank you, love. It's my wedding anniversary today, if my wife... that's why we married, love. Curse God and die. Thanks for the encouragement and the advice. Now, we ought to say a word about Mrs. Job here, because she does get rather dumped on in Job. But if you read about it, she gets really, really bad press. Mrs. Job has also lost everything, hasn't she? She's lost all of her children. And she'll have to care for her husband until what apparently looks like he's dying now. So now she's going to be his carer until he dies. And when he dies, because it's that sort of society, there is no pension, there is no, you know, a nursing home, there is no life insurance for women in that culture. That's it. You're gone. You have nothing. You are destitute. You'll probably starve to death now. And she's just giving voice to the thoughts that have occurred to Job too. Job doesn't say what she says, but I think he was probably thinking it. Notice what he says to her in response. Listen to this, verse 10. Should we accept only good from the hand of the Lord and never anything bad? He's struggling now. And I think it's right today. I love the Bible because it says, you know what? He's struggling now. He's struggling to understand God and who God is now. Who is this God? Does he give us good things or bad? What's going on? Is God the kind of person who sends trouble or evil? Is God really good? He's struggling. And he's asking questions about this God he worships. And in verse 11, some new characters appear on the lower stage. They're Job's friends. What are they called affectionately? Job's what? Job's comforters. Yeah, we use that to people who attempt to say nice things to us and fail badly, don't we? You know, who wish they kept their mouth shut. Job's comforters. And Job's friends all come to sympathize with us. The Hebrew verb for this is a very physical verb, when they come to sympathize with us. It referred to body movement. And it's actually a physical thing that people do. Have you ever seen people who rock back and forwards when they're traumatized? Now that's the word. It's physical. And these guys have come and they are such good friends to Job. They are such good friends that they're physically expressing in their trauma, what is going on? You sometimes see it when a person goes into shock. When someone goes into shock, it sort of expresses itself. They sort of rock or physically collapse in a certain way. That's what happens to these guys. They're good guys. It's easy to be down on these people, like Job's wife and the comforters. They're good people. They really do care about Job. And they do that. And their love is so great for Job Their grief is so intense. They plan. This is what they get. They could plan to sit with him and just take on his anguish. That's what they're going to do. We're just going to sit with you and feel what you feel. Fantastic friends. Amazing. Verse 12. When they saw Job from a distance, they scarcely recognized him, wailing loudly. They tore their robes. They threw dust in the air over their heads to show their grief. They were very physical about their trauma over their friend. You ever been sick and had someone visit you, take one look at you and burst into tears? It worries you, doesn't it, when they do that? They go, whoa! And you go, whoa, am I that bad? But, you know, but that's what they do. This is not a good thing. It tells you how desperate Job's condition is and how deeply they love him. They just weep. Amazing. And they sit on the ground with him for 7 days without saying a word. A whole week, they sit with him and they don't say a word. Such a powerful thing to do for this guy. You ever done that for someone? What do? We get alongside someone who's in pain, and what do? Straight away, we start talking. Probably the last thing they need. We start talking. And this was such a powerful act in this day that Jewish tradition will speak of a thing called sitting Shiva. It literally means sitting sevens. Friends would come and they would sit with the one who mourns and they would remain silent and just sit with them for a whole week. No joke, that was the tradition in Jewish culture. It's amazing. We could do with about that when we're mourning, when we're suffering, for someone to do that for us. It's what Paul's getting at when he says in the New Testament, in Romans 12, it says, mourn with those who mourn. You don't explain stuff, you don't comfort them, you don't sympathize. You just sit there and you're with them in it. You don't say a word. Fantastic. I love that. Paul says, mourn with those who mourn. Paul doesn't say, give really good advice to those who mourn, because they don't need that. He doesn't say fix people who mourn, because we try and do that all the time. He says go and mourn with them. Mourn with those who mourn. And that takes self-giving, doesn't it? That takes self-sacrificial love to do that. And it's interesting that after 7 days, Job's friends start speaking a lot. If they'd only shut up and stayed quiet, they'd have done really well. But then they start, like we all do, speaking a lot. And their words, unlike their initial response, their words are not quite so helpful. Their words are a little bit off. Their silence was brilliant. It was a gift. Their words, not quite so much. It's one of the reasons why Job is able to persevere with God, I think, because they just sat with him. He was able to hang in there because they just said, okay, we're here. Full stop. Silence. And after that silence, after all that time, Job speaks. And if he can just repeat what he said in chapter 1, God gives, God takes away, blessed be the name of the Lord, then this test will be over. It'll be a really short book. But Job opens his mouth and he starts with feelings that often where people in suffering start with. He curses the day of his birth. It's the kind of thing that keeps Job off the motivational speaker list, actually. You know, he didn't invite Job along because he'd be just getting a bit morose about this sort of stuff. Job 3, 2 to 3. This is how he responds the second time around. Let the day of my birth be erased, the night I was conceived. He's getting into a little bit of self-pity now. And then he gets creative with his disdain for the day that he was born. He says, let those who are experts at cursing, whose cursing should rouse Leviathan, curse that day that I was born, verse 8. I didn't know there was a gift of cursing, but apparently there is. And Job's looking for people to volunteer and help him out here. And for the next 28 chapters, the rest of this book, really, he pours out a level of bitterness and anger and confusion towards God that is amazing to see in the Bible. That's why I love the Bible, you know what? There's all sorts of stuff in the Bible that says, this isn't right, I don't like you, God, what are you playing at? Get me out of this, sort this out, you're not fair, and it's all there. Fantastic, isn't it? I love that about the Bible. It says it's okay to feel those things sometimes. So staggering. It's so staggering that his three friends can't stand it and they start to argue with him. which is where they went wrong. They all express fundamental idea that belonged to the culture at the time. And the idea is spread all over the place. It's even in the church today. The idea is that whatever you're experiencing is what you've called upon yourself by how you live. You are responsible for all the stuff that's going on right now. And sometimes that's true, but not always. Some suffering has no explanation and no reason. And Job can't stand it when they say this over and over again. Job, you must have done something wrong. How else can you explain your suffering? And Job just responds like this. You're wrong. I haven't done anything wrong. And they can't believe it. No, you must have done something. It's your fault that you're suffering. Can't be God. Must be you. And he just argues with them. It's not that. You've got it wrong. And the whole middle section of the book is the same argument over and over and over again. Job, you've done something wrong. Job says, no, I haven't. And they say, no, this explains it. You must be, you know, it's consequences of your own sin. And Job says, no, it isn't. And it just goes on and on and on for chapter after chapter. The writer wants you to understand how devastating to the soul it is whenever that happens. When you have done nothing wrong and you suffer and people blame you. How desperately, desperately hard that is. And Job questioned God and he tries to cling to God and he accuses God and all this goes on. And Job says, verse 23, listen to this, chapter 23, verse 3. If only I knew where to find God, I'd go to his court. If only I knew about this upper stage. I would lay out my case and present my arguments, but he can't see the upper stage and he can't get there. If only God would show up, I'd take him to court and I would question him. That's how Job is feeling. Maybe you've felt like that sometimes. God, get in the dock. I'm going to ask you some questions. I'm going to accuse you. I am the prosecution. Chapter 38, Job gets his wish. Imagine that. Imagine if you got your wish and the next time you say, God, explain yourself. And God showed up. Job gets his wish. The text says, the Lord answered Job from the whirlwind. Job 38, verse 1. And the rest of the book is about God's answer. So most of it is this argument between Job and his friends. The really key chapters, chapter 1 and 2, and chapter 38 onwards. The middle bit is just a big argument about, it's my fault, no it isn't. But the front and the back of that book are so key. Can you imagine what it was like for Job? Listen to God in Job 38. Job 38, verse 2. Who is it that questions my wisdom with such ignorant words? Brace yourself like a man, because I have some questions for you, Job. And you must answer them. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me, if you know so much. Who determined its dimensions, stretched out the surveying line? Who supports its foundations? Who laid its cornerstone? And the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy. Now you notice here that God, when he shows up, doesn't answer Job's question. Why am I suffering? You notice that? What does he do? He just asks him a lot of questions. Doesn't tell Job what's going on the upper stage. He never reveals the conversation that happened and the challenge and what's at stake. Self-interest or sacrificial love, which controls the universe, which is underpinning reality, which of those two, the big test of which one's right, the God or Satan. He doesn't say anything about that. And it looked kind of mean when you read it. Kind of like, I'm big and you're small, so shut up, Job. But part of what's happening here is God pointing out to Job that Job has a very finite view. He can't see the top stage. But there's something more going on. And he's trying to help Job see it. A scholar named Alan David points out that in the Old Testament, God's questions here in this end of this chapter indicate something about the kind of person God is. That it's really the hinge of this whole story. That Job's understanding of the character of God is what this is all about. Who is God really? Chapter 38, verse 25 is what it says. God says, who created the channel for the torrents of rain? Who laid out the path of the lightning? Who makes the rain fall on barren land? In a desert where no one lives. Who sends rain to satisfy the parched ground and make the tender grass spring up? And all of God's questions are asking this, what sort of God am I, Job? That's what they're all trying to tease out of Job. What sort of God am I? Let me describe what I do and then work out who I am. See if you give it a go, Job. I'll ask you some questions. Doesn't answer his problem, just asks him about his view of his God. And he talks about this barren land and water falling on it. Now here, why? Here's what would jump out to an Israelite living in a dry, thirsty land. Why would God water a land where nobody lives? What sort of God is this? Why does he do that? Isn't that a waste of resources? Is that a bit of a waste of time? Why does he do that? Because God is good. Sometimes God is good for no reason whatsoever. He's a God of gratuitous goodness. He is good. He gives because he loves to give, even when it doesn't appear to be strategic or purposeful or useful. He just waters empty land where nobody lives. What sort of God am I, Job? All God's questions keep showing him as someone who delights in creation, who serves and cares for everything that nobody actually has any time for, that we wouldn't bother with. He's that sort of God. And his descriptions and his questions in these chapters, God's questions are all about that. So in chapter 39, for instance, let me give you an example. He talks about the ostrich. Ostriches are stupid animals. Have you ever seen an ostrich? They look stupid. I mean, why would you design an ostrich? Do you know an ostrich's IQ is so low? It's so low. When it lays an egg, it often forgets where it's laid it. That's serious. An ostrich is a pointless work. It really is. Why, God, would you make one of those? What's the point? What benefit? I mean, it's a really dim critter. And the writer says, you know, he talks about the ostrich in chapter 39, 13 to 18. God just endows her with beauty of speed. That's all he does. She's fast, but she's rubbish at everything else and looks silly, even when she runs. But she's fast. And God says, I made that. Why? Because I'm just gratuitously generous and loving, and I love to make stuff, even when it's a bit pointless. That's who I am, Job. That's who I am. Chapter 40, you can read it, he talks about the behemoth. And we think the behemoth is probably referring to the hippo. Ancient world considered the hippo as a bit of a problem because they actually cause more deaths in Africa. If you know about, it's not the lions, the tigers, it's not those in Africa. You know what kills more people in Africa? Hippos. No joke. They're dangerous little critters, and they're also a little bit pointless, really. They don't do anything except cause trouble, most hippos. Steer clear of them. God says, I was cooking on gas when I made them. They're fantastic. Love them. And he goes on to talk about he delights in the wild ox that never pulls a plow and the wild donkey that will never be tamed or drag your gear up a mountain because you can't tame it. And he talks about the wild goat that gives birth in secret places that no one will ever see and nobody will ever appreciate, possibly with the exception of David Attenborough if he's keen enough. You know, and he talks about the Leviathan and the crocodile and all sorts of stuff that, you know, all these crazy animals that he made for no apparent reason, quite frankly. The whole section is about God creating and delighting in animals that aren't good for anything. Why would God make a world like that? And he's saying, Job, answer me. Who am I? Why don't I behave like this? Why? Because he's the kind of person who revels in the beauty of his least strategic creature. Because he's gratuitously good. Because he loves to be creative and create life. Because he's uncontrollably generous. Because he's irrationally loving. That's what he's saying to Job all the way through this. It's his nature. You see, in all this conversation, Job finds out the kind of person God is: irrationally loving, gratuitously good, irredeemably generous. And Job never does find out about the upper stage. He's never told about the conversation that took place in heaven. Because Job's story is our story, it's yours and mine. And here on earth, we live on this lower stage, but Job finds out something even better. He finds out who God is, though he may never find out the reason for his suffering. That God is loving beyond Job's wildest dreams. And can Job trust that in the midst of his suffering? It's why Job makes this amazing statement right at the end when God finally stops questioning him. He says this: "My ears have heard about you." Chapter 42, verse 5. "My ears have heard about you, but now my eyes have seen you. Now I see you, God, for the first time in who you really are." And that's enough for Job. He never gets an answer, but that's enough for Job. Because God comes down from the upper stage to the lower stage so that Job can see who he is, and that's his only answer. And it's a little foretaste, isn't it, of a day when God would come down in the person of Jesus to the lower stage, and God would come and sit with us in our ash heap, with our bit of pottery, when God would come to be with us, and he would leave the upper stage, and he would join us on the lower one. To take on Job's suffering and your suffering and my suffering and our sin on the cross. And God would say to everybody on this lower stage, this is what he says: "Anybody, whoever you are and whatever you're going through, you come to me and give me your suffering too. Because I'm a great big God and I will give you hope. And I will give you comfort and I will hold your hand and I will never let it go. I will sit with you in the midst of the brokenness of this world. And it matters what you're going through. It matters. Because I know. And I see. And I will come down to be with you in the midst of it. That's why it matters." You see, self-giving and self-sacrificial love is at the core of this universe, not self-interest, and Jesus came to prove it. And then it ends up with this little epilogue in chapter 2, and God speaks to Job's friends, to his comforters, and he says this, Job 42, verse 7, says to these friends who've started out so well, 7 days of silence, he says this: "I'm angry with you and your two friends, for you have not spoken accurately about me," because that's God's point in the end. Do you really know who I am? "You have not spoken accurately about me as my servant Job has. You've got to picture their amazement. They know they're right. And then God shows up and says, "Nope, Job was right. But if Job will pray for you, I'll forgive you." I imagine Job and his friends had a very interesting conversation at the end of this book. And then we find out about the end of Job's life. Verse 12 of chapter 42. "So the Lord blessed Job in the second half of his life more than in the beginning. For now he had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 team of oxen, and 1,000 female donkeys." It's almost doubled. "And he also gave Job 7 more sons and 3 more daughters. He named the first daughter Jemima, the second Keziah, the third Karen Hapush, and in all the land, no women were as lovely as the daughters of Job. And their father put them into his will along with their brothers." Now, I always thought this is a weird ending. We don't need to know about that. We just got a picture of God, and that God is with us in our suffering, and the heart of the universe is not self-interest. The devil was wrong. Jesus proves it. Job proves it. They're in self-sacrificial love, unconditional love that is at the heart of everything. Now, this seems like an odd finish. But that's because we miss things that would jump out to anybody who was a Hebrew and reading at the time. For instance, first thing they'd notice is that the writer gives the names of only the sum of his children, his daughters, whose names he mentions. Why does he mention these daughters, these three daughters? And they're strange names. In ancient literature, names are really significant. Hebrew names were very serious things. They meant something. But these three names of Job's daughters are all about beauty. They're kind of wasteful. Jemima was the Hebrew word for dove, a bird of shade, colour, considered lovely. The second daughter is Kezia. Kezia is the word for cinnamon, a very precious and beautiful spice. Third daughter, Karen Hapush, strange name of all. It meant horn of eyeshadow. It's makeup. He names his third kid after some makeup. It's like naming your kid L'Oreal. Or Oil of Ulay. And he calls her that. Because it's beautiful. Because it's a sign of beauty. And he calls her that. It's a bit mad, Joe, but there you go. Not only does he give the text their names, they're weird names, but he gives them an inheritance. Do you know anything about this culture? Did women get inheritances in those days? Why? Because that was wasteful. Because you know what? If you gave your inheritance to a wife, it would leave the family. If you give your inheritance to the blokes, it stays in the family because they've got the family name and they keep it and it stays within the family. But you give inheritance to the women and it disappears off to some other family and you'll never get it back. That's why nobody ever did it. Why does Job start doing this, which was completely countercultural? Maybe it's because he's seen a God who is ridiculously generous, amazingly loving. Maybe he's seen God, and maybe it's rubbing off. Maybe that's why. He wants us to know now Job is being gratuitously good and uncontrollably generous and irrationally loving for no reason and for no benefit to him at all. Does that remind you of somebody? It reminds you of the God who he's seen for the first time. It's the story of the triumph of self-sacrificial love of God. It is the promise that Satan is wrong. That what makes this world tick is not self-interest. It is self-sacrificial love. The central question in the book is, can human beings hold on to God and faith and love when it doesn't seem like it pays off for me personally? Can I hold on? Well, one man could, and one man did. Job could never see the upper stage. He could never see that upper stage. He didn't know that his faithfulness and his suffering had meaning, that it was an advert to the whole of creation that God is right and that Satan is wrong. And your faithfulness, your commitment to love God, even when there's no benefit to doing it for you personally, is a declaration to the devil and to the world that self-sacrificial love, not self-interest, is the heart of creation. Your suffering matters. Because whenever you worship God, despite it all, that's what you're declaring. You are the biggest advert that God is right and the devil is wrong. And who knows, maybe like Job, you might inspire millions of people. And you might declare to the universe that love, not self-interest, is at the heart of everything. But you only do that by hanging on. by trusting in this amazing, gratuitously generous God, and by seeing him for the first time. Now my eyes have seen you. And you worship him anyway. You worship him anyway. Your suffering matters. He wants us to know. He wants us to say that not just, the writer wants us to say that not just to Job, but to say it to ourselves, to say it to other people. To say to the people around us who suffer, who anguish, who hurt, but don't understand. To say to them, don't give up, don't let go, you hang on. You keep going, your perseverance matters, your suffering matters, it has meaning. And it sends out the biggest message to the universe. The most important message that everybody needs to hear. We're going to sing as we close. Reminding ourselves that our little life, our suffering, means more than we can imagine. You are part of something bigger. You are part of something that's going on the big stage above that you never see. You are part of that. And even your suffering is part of that. We live in the land of Uz. That's all we can see. Everybody suffers, and some in this room are suffering right now. That's the truth. Why? I don't know. How long will it last? I don't know. Does your response matter? More than you can imagine. On that big stage that you can't see, it matters more than you could possibly imagine. So don't let go.